What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Caitlin Beatty. I reached out to Caitlin because she has an awesome book called A Woman's Place, and it's all about women and the workplace and the value of women in the workplace. And I feel like that's something we've talked about in previous episodes, but nothing I've like really dug down into specifically. And in, you know, our sort of Christian subculture, it can feel like women's work is not really valued. You know, there's lots of different opinions out there about women in the workplace. And I just wanted to sort of to get into all of that and really talk about the value of women in the workplace and why, you know, women should find work valuable and how we talk about that as a church. And so Caitlin does a fantastic job of talking about all that. She talks about her story of being the youngest female editor of Christianity Today ever, and just how all that went down and what her experience in the workplace has been like. And then we get into some of the theology of that, of work and of women. And it's just a really good episode. You're going to love hearing from her. You're going to love hearing a lot of her wisdom about this topic. So I can't wait for you to hear it. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram at Theology of Hustle, same on Facebook and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the podcast and everything we got going out. There's some great stuff. Check me out on YouTube at Bootleg Bible College, where I just break down some of the things I think you need to know about the Bible and theology. So I'd appreciate you checking out all that, and I hope you enjoy hearing from Caitlin. Well, Caitlin, I can't say thanks enough for coming on the show and talking with me a little bit. It's super nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Let's maybe jump off here and just have you sort of introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Okay. I am Caitlin Beatty, and I am currently an acquisitions editor with Brazos Press, which is a Christian publisher based in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I've been with them for 2 years, and in that time, I've also lived in New York City. So I work remotely, and that's great. Although, you know, living in New York right now is not the greatest, but we can talk about that later. Before I joined the team at Brazos, I freelanced for a couple years. I wrote a book that came out in 2016 called A Woman's Place, A Christian Vision for Your Calling in the Office, the Home, and the World. And that was really a book about theology of vocation, specifically for women, just trying to fill what I perceived to be a gap in faith and work conversations in the church, and have also, you know, written for essays and articles and reports for mainstream media. Before that, I worked at Christianity Today magazine for almost a decade in various editorial roles, and the last 4 years that I was there was the managing editor of the print magazine. So yeah, learned a lot about evangelical institutions and evangelical history and how to get things done on deadline and how to respond to angry emails from subscribers. So it was a very formative experience. Spent all of my 20s at CT. And yeah, before that, I'm a Midwesterner through and through. This is my first time living outside the Midwest. Went to Calvin College, now Calvin University in Grand Rapids, for undergrad, studied communications and journalism, and really just have always been drawn to the written word and to publishing. So I'm grateful to have found myself on a career path that aligns with what I care about and what I think I'm, you know, naturally suited to do.
So were you always just sort of a reader? Like, how did your love for like the printed word sort of manifest itself in your life?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of nerdy children, I spent a lot of time reading books. That was always like a natural enjoyment of mine. And I, maybe more centrally though, I really liked school and I really liked college. So one thing that I really liked about being in a scholarly setting was the opportunity to research a topic and research an idea and then bring my thesis or my idea together through research and writing and piecing together an argument in a paper. So I for the most part, enjoyed writing papers in college.
Yeah.
I mean, not for like economics. There were right. certain classes where that was never going to be fun, but just realizing that I actually really enjoyed, I enjoyed the process of learning, reading, researching, and writing and bringing together my own idea or argument. As an undergrad, I was also part of the student newspaper. And so I would, my primary role was copy editing, but I also would occasionally write movie reviews or op-eds, you know, about particular issues on campus, and
yeah.
just really enjoyed the opportunity to contribute to a broader conversation on campus, and shape how people thought and felt about particular issues that were coming up on campus.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, that was probably my first exposure to publishing. I mean, I grew up knowing. I grew up knowing about Christianity Today magazine. My parents were subscribers, and I saw it lying around our house, and kind of knew that it was this flagship Christian publication. And I found it to be—I mean, it didn't agree with everything in the magazine, and I still don't, of course. But you know, I found it to be really thoughtful and well done. And, you know, I appreciated that level of kind of intellectual credibility and rigor from a Christian publication.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Just the Christianity Today trajectory, you know, like the Billy Graham sort of foundations and all of that, and sort of, I don't know, maybe where we've come, you know, with this, like where evangelicalism has come sort of with this fundamentalism, you know, the divide, and it's gotten strange, I think. And Christianity Today is like a major part of some of that culture shaping, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that point, I think Christianity Today, the editors and leaders there have done a really good job of trying to create unity among readers. I mean, in a lot of ways, I appreciate that CT doesn't take a political side per se.
Right.
And for that, you know, some readers are like, oh, CT, they're so conservative, how annoying. And then other readers are like, oh, CT, so liberal, they're, you know, doing the devil's work or something. And I feel like that was always a sign as editors that we were doing something right, that we were getting attacked from both sides. But I also, I mean, just more recently, you know, Christianity Today published an editorial at the end of last year supporting President Trump's impeachment. Obviously, that made a big splash.
Yes, yes, it did.
The president himself tweeted about Christianity Today.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, CT does a good job of creating unity in a very polarized, fragmented time, but also having the moral courage to speak up on things that really matter when the time is right, on the most significant things, knowing that that's not going to please everybody, but as a magazine, you're shaping and informing, but you're also leading. And sometimes leadership puts you in the line of fire because people don't agree with you or they think you're wrong. So I think, yes, evangelicalism at large is kind of a mess in the United States right now, and we could have a separate conversation about all the reasons why that is. But, you know, I think CT is doing a good job in the midst of a lot of external pressure and confusion.
Yeah, I very much agree. Yes, so much yes. So what was it like to, I don't know, like join the staff of CT? And I don't want to lose this focus of sort of like women in the workspace specifically, because you wrote a book about it that was incredible. But like, I mean, being a female editor at an evangelical publication isn't a small task, I guess. Is that true?
Oh, Curry, where do I start? You know, yeah. Yes, it was not easy. Although I think it got better over time. I think the workplace culture changed in the 9+ years that I was part of the staff. But when I first came on, you know, back in 2007, there were two other women editors on a staff of about 15 editors, and we were all assistant editors. We were just kind of like coming in from college, and certainly there were no women in positions of leadership on the magazine staff. I mean, corporately, OCT is part of this broader ministry. There were women leaders on the business side of things, but not so much in the editorial side. And so that was challenging just in part because there weren't a lot of role models for what it might look like to stay on at the magazine as a woman and take on more leadership responsibilities and a leadership title. It was just like, I don't know what this looks like, because everywhere I look, the leaders are like my dad's age and they've been here for 20 years. And and certain ways of talking and carrying on and like making sports jokes, you know, there was like a cultural disconnect for me. But I decided to just kind of put my head down and get the work done. I mean, the first couple of years, my primary responsibility was copy editing the magazine. I remember there being a really specific kind of turn a couple of years in where I was invited to these editorial meetings, and it was a monthly meeting where some of the top editors, so to speak, would get together for breakfast. They were always at like 7 a.m, which was horrendous. And we'd come and talk and banter and decide as a group what the magazine was going to editorialize on that particular month in the print issue. And one of us would be assigned to write it. And it was kind of this, you know, the editorial was a statement about where the magazine stands. And so it had this kind of institutional heft and weight to it. And I came and pitched an editorial about how it's wrong for Christians to use dehumanizing language against Hillary Clinton. And that actually proved to be very prescient. I don't know if you know, but she later went on to run for president and like, yeah, some of the language about her was not great.
Yeah, it just got worse.
It got worse. Yeah, my editorial didn't really like turn the tide, unfortunately. But they were, you know, the editors were like, yeah, this is a great idea. Write it. It made it, you know, got some attention. And so I guess that experience was important to me simply because it showed that I could contribute to the magazine beyond copy editing and could take more of a thought leadership role. And shortly thereafter, another editor and I would start Hermeneutics, which was the women's women's blog of the magazine for several years. And yeah, that was an amazing opportunity to bring in more women writers and cover the news and theology from a female perspective and just highlight that perspective and voice in a way that I think changed the magazine's culture for the better and made it more equitable among gender lines. So, you know, I certainly, when I was managing editor, there was awkwardness at times about being a young woman, having a direct report who was my dad's age. And I don't think either of us felt super comfortable about the social dynamics of that. But I think over time, you know, those dynamics are, people just get used to a new normal. And, you know, having a woman in a leadership position becomes the new normal. And hopefully it sets a tone and a goal for the future. It's not just, well, we had our one female managing editor. That was a great time. But being open to that, to more and more women being in leadership positions, and that it has a cumulative effect over time. So,
yeah, I mean, every time you break down one of those barriers, right, it's just easier to move over that next time, right? It's not like a big discussion, like, can we do this? It's like, no, it's been, you set a precedent, right? So
I hope so. But I would also say that it really does take a proactive commitment on the part of other leaders to say, we don't want this to be a barrier for other women who come after the first, right? Like, we don't want a magazine that looks and feels like a men's magazine. We want our staff and our perspectives in the magazine to represent the full diversity of the body of Christ. And of course, that is inclusive of gender diversity, but also racial diversity and denominational right. diversity and ideological diversity. And there really has to be a commitment on the part of leaders to pursue that diversity. Otherwise, it's really easy to fall back into old patterns.
Yeah. Right. For every organization. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's an important piece that's really easy to like just let fall by the wayside unless you're prioritizing it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So before we jump into a little more of the book, I kind of want to know like, okay, so now you're at Brazos, you're writing, you know, some op-eds and some of this stuff out in the wide world. What does it look like? What is your job entail right now? Like, what does even somebody in acquisitions do at a publishing company?
So my primary responsibility is, as the title implies, to acquire new books.
Sure.
And so Brazos is part of Baker Publishing Group. Brazos is a division within Baker. We sometimes use the language of thoughtful trade.
Okay.
So we're not publishing academic works. We have a separate academic division. So we're definitely serving the trade market, but we want our books to have a certain theological and intellectual rigor, as well as kind of cultural engagement that goes beyond kind of the self-help devotional vibe of a lot of sure. Christian trade, for better or worse.
Sure.
So my day-to-day job, I mean, of course it varies, but I am connecting with writers, scholars, pastors, activists, just some people with some kind of public platform who I feel have something important to say to the church, and over time building relationship with authors and essentially convincing them to publish a book with Brazos. You know, there are all sorts of variables that go into that. You know, obviously a lot of authors work with agents, and so then I'm building a relationship with an agent more than the author, or I'm corresponding with an agent more than an author. Sometimes for a lot of authors, they really want to write a book and they have the vision for a book, but they just can't get to it for another year. And so then my role becomes, how do I gently annoy them, but not so much that they say no, but like just enough that they're like, okay, fine, I'll do it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, pre-pandemic time, there was a fair amount of travel to conferences and events, or just kind of one-on-one coffee meetings to connect with authors in person. And so over time, you have so many conversations. Some of those people you connect with are going to come back to you and say, hey, I'm ready to move forward with my book idea. Here's my proposal. Then once we start getting proposals, there's a whole process internally of how our team kind of signs off on a proposal and makes an offer. And there's negotiations in that, and sometimes you're in a competitive situation, you know. Other publishers might be also looking at the same proposal, and then you hope that you make an offer that is competitive. So there's a lot of back and forth at that point in the process. But then once we've contracted a book, you know, then my primary role becomes more like a developmental editor, working with an author through their manuscript, through the first draft, and really shaping it and improving it and strengthening it, and then passing it along to another editor who can get more into the weeds of the edits. But it's very relational, it's entrepreneurial, it's pretty independent. I mean, of course I have meetings with my colleagues you know, every week, every couple weeks. I'm in a lot of conversation with our marketing team, just looking at some of the books that I've acquired now going out into the world, and of course hoping that they actually sell. But yeah, I like it a lot. I like the relational aspect. I think, you know, compared with working at a magazine, the pace of publishing is more manageable. Huh. I think a lot of folks working in more of a journalistic environment, experience burnout just from the new, from the constant news cycle and the craziness of the news cycle and how do you keep up with everything. And you decide to write an article and it was due yesterday. And that over time, I think I found working at CT that that pace was pretty exhausting. There are, of course, deadlines in book publishing, but they're just not intense in the way that that magazine publishing is.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's cool because you, it seems like you get to wear a lot of hats. Like, you know, getting out and connecting mode is very different than like editing mode or like, you know, helping somebody walk through the process. Like, seems like you get to do a lot of the things that sort of give you life in a lot of these different places, right?
Yeah. And I still, you know, when I have time, I still write on the side in my spare time. So I continue to write occasionally for mainstream news publications, usually on issues of kind of faith and culture, very broadly defined. And then I am also writing a second book that will be published by Brazos. So my boss will become my editor at that time, but I'm writing a book on dynamics of celebrity in the church and grappling with the lure of fame in evangelicalism. And have to start writing that. So this is a good reminder that I'm behind.
Okay. Well, I'll remind you when I email you a follow-up, you know, just to like work on your book, if that works for you. Yeah, that's interesting. Celebrity in Christianity has kind of exploded recently. I was just talking to somebody who specifically focuses on Pentecostalism. You know, she's like a, she's a scholar for Pentecostals. And I find it interesting that Pentecostals are so spirit driven, right? Like in a lot of ways, you know, because of the whole role of the Holy Spirit in people's lives, everybody's sort of on an even playing field. It's very egalitarian in that way. Mm-hmm. Yet they have this penchant for celebrity pastors more than other evangelicals do. I find it an interesting curiosity, I guess. I've been thinking a little bit about celebrities as well.
Mean, I'm hoping that, you know, by the time the book comes out in a couple years, this will still be a conversation that people are interested in engaging. And I unfortunately have to think like there will be kind of celebrity pastor scandals between now and then, or just, you know, church cultures or institutional cultures where the role of celebrity and like the famous charismatic leader has had negative effects and people will be, you know, interested in engaging it. But it's not just a critical project. It's also looking at why humans are drawn to celebrity as a form of power and why this might be kind of endemic to American evangelicalism and how we ourselves as readers or consumers feed the celebrity dynamic. What is it like, what is it appealing to in ourselves? And really just capturing the vision of ordinary faithfulness, which is, I think, something that we might have lost. There's of course like the call to do big things for God, but what if the big thing for God is having like a sit down conversation with your neighbor who annoys you and like really expressing love and care for them, and nobody sees it and it's not on Instagram and like you don't get new followers from it.
Yep.
But it's, God sees it and God cares about those kind of hidden ordinary moments of obedience.
Agree. I totally agree. I think that's a lot of what I'm trying to do here on the podcast, you know, because it is like everybody's a part of God's kingdom, right? I've had a high schooler on the show. I've had, you know, like I try to cover the gambit because all of our work is valuable to the kingdom. And I think we've definitely missed that. It's all like pastors do God's work. I think this is a nerdy book reference, but I think Tolkien and, you know, the Lord of the Rings series, like the hobbits are such like a interesting, you know, they like just love life and they love eating and they love like relaxing and they're just like they're the most normal creatures in all of the book, or the most, you know, laid back and willing to kind of and I think there's just something very, very specific about why he did that way. And I think that gets lost, you know, sometimes. So anyway.
And the fact that the hobbits were the ones to destroy the ring and effectively save Middle Earth. I mean, I'm totally tracking with you.
Yeah, the only ones that could really, though, right? Everybody else with this power was could be easily seduced.
Right.
But when you didn't have the power, there was no seduction there to wield that power.
Right. Oh, man. I want to go back and... I would say read it. I love the book, but I'm more inclined to watch the full 12-hour experience from... Peter Jackson.
I totally get that. I just went through my first time through the entire thing reading it, so it's a little bit fresh on the brain, you know.
Mm-hmm,
so
it's a good one.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I've been following some of your writing. I mean, you just recently wrote on QAnon and like what is it like to be sort of forward facing in the world, especially on. You know, more controversial topics like that you write on some.
Well, some days it's great. with the QAnon piece, that was something that Religion News Service published a couple weeks ago. And you know, the idea for that article really just came from seeing a lot of church leaders on social media talk about QAnon's spread among members of their church or in their broader Christian community, and they were concerned. And I really wanted, I didn't know that much about QAnon, although I've heard a lot more about it over the last few months. And so I was really curious to see, what is QAnon? Why is it appealing to some Christians? Why is it concerning to some pastors? How are pastors planning to respond? And I think writing things like that, part of what I'm hoping to do is to inform, like to help people understand a contemporary cultural trend or conversation and apply faith to understanding what's going on. And with the QAnon article, you know, that was, I think, also meeting like a felt need. You know, there were people who had lots of people who have also been hearing a lot about QAnon, but may not know what it is or how it works. And there are spiritual dimensions to it that I think are alarming to a lot of people. And so my desire was really to inform and educate and hopefully have pastors and church leaders take that information and then figure out how they want to respond in their own contexts. You know, the internet is a really weird place. There are people who, you know, with this specific article, I think are really, they have fallen down the QAnon rabbit hole. And that worldview takes on a very black and white, good versus evil dynamic. And so if you criticize QAnon, you're part of this evil cover up. You're doing evil work. And so, yeah, naturally I get emails through my website or Facebook messages that are not super pleasant to engage. But I think anyone writing about, any journalist writing for the internet right now has experienced similar dynamics. And I think you do kind of over time become a little desensitized in a good way. You know, those words don't stay with you. You can just delete the email. You don't have to write back. I think it's harder when what you're writing is more personal.
Right.
Because then the criticism in response feels more personal. And also when the criticism is coming from someone you know or someone that has some clout or they have this visibility in online discourse, that can be very painful. So yeah, I mean, I won't go into, very briefly, when my book came out, a journalist wrote a profile of me in The Atlantic, and there was a line in the piece that didn't come out how I wanted about stay-at-home moms. Of course, that's like a lightning rod issue, of course. Totally. And a writer and blogger picked up that one line from the piece and used that, you know, not only to defend stay-at-home moms, which of course is fine, but he really took aim at me and started the piece by pointing out that, you know, I'm not married and I don't have kids and I'm in my early 30s. And so what would I know about any of this? Mm. And even like a couple of our mutual friends reached out to him and said like, hey, that's not fair. That's not what her book says. And that's when it's more painful, yeah. when it's something personal. And unfortunately, you know, in this time of online rancor and deep, deep polarization in the U.S., it is really easy to, for a lot of us, to fall back on dehumanizing language and to forget mm. that you really are engaging with flesh and blood image bearers yeah. on the other side of the screen. And that's a challenge to me as well in my own tweeting and use of social media. Like, am I able to even critique or be part of important conversations without devolving into kind of a dehumanizing approach? Mm. Because I know what it feels like to be the recipient of that. So,
yeah. Well, and especially as Christians, I mean, to dehumanize others is, you know, it's blasphemy, you know, honestly. Mm. And so, but it's so easy for Christians to do. And we've fallen into this trap of, you know, it's a very easy track to go down, you know, and I just, yeah, it's sad, mm-hmm. I guess. Uh-huh. Yeah. So anyway, I mean, cause you talk, even your book, like I've noticed some stuff on Twitter where, you know, you'll talk about sort of the, you know, these gender roles, right. And nothing, I mean, there are a lot of like really fragile, Christian men out there that like any talk about women having any sort of power whatsoever, just sort of like, sets them off. Right. Mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. and so your book is like striking at the heart of a lot of that. And I think in like really healthy and really helpful ways for people to understand the role of women in work. So can we talk just a little bit about I know it's been a while since you wrote it, so we don't need to get into the nitty gritty, but why write the book? And can you kind of give a flyover view maybe a little bit?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So I say this a lot, and I think other book authors say this or experience this, which is that you are compelled to write the book that you wish that you had or what you wish yeah. mm. existed earlier in your life. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I spent all of my 20s kind of really investing in my work at Christianity Today. And, you know, I'm not married, don't have kids. The Wheaton suburbs, which is where I lived for that time. I don't know if you've noticed this. It is a little bit family oriented.
Yeah, just a touch.
So
yeah.
I think as I got older, I really started grappling with questions of identity and really started to ask, well, okay, if the most important thing I can do or be as a Christian woman is to be a wife and mother, and that isn't on the horizon and is just not my waking reality, what is the spiritual value of my daily work? Does God value that work? Does mm-hmm. the church value yeah. that work? Do I value that work? Or is it a feeling of it being second best or less than in some way? And so I really wanted to dig into the positive, to cast a vision for the positive spiritual dimensions of our daily work, especially for women, because I think a lot of Christian women grapple with competing narratives about what it means to be Christian women, and just really wanting to see whether these women are married or single or have kids or don't have kids or whatever age or part of their career they're in, really wanting to say, like, we need women in the workplace because God has equipped his followers to do good redemptive work in the world through their daily work. And if women aren't part of that workforce and professional life, we're really missing out on the unique redemptive mm-hmm. role that they play in their spheres of influence. Yeah. So some of this too is really just about, you know, beyond kind of affirming women's work in the workplace, affirming the role of quote unquote non-spiritual work. You know, I think right. a lot of us still contend with a narrative that says, like, explicitly Christian work is the most valuable, or ministry is the most valuable kind of work that you can do. Mm-hmm. And all this, you know, the work of accountants, the work of coffee shop owners, the work of teachers, that's all fine, but it's kind of second best, or it's secular. It just doesn't have anything to do with the gospel.
Right.
And there's a really robust Reformed theological tradition that says, no, like all arenas of life are under God's sovereignty and part of God's care, and are places where God calls his followers to go out and do good work and bless their neighbors and contribute to cultural renewal. Mm. And the work of the, I don't know, shoemaker, this is like a famous Martin Luther reference, like the work of the shoemaker is no less important than the work of the pastor. And do we really believe that, you know?
Right.
And also talking about how we do our work as Christians, you know, the meaning of our work is not simply that we have an opportunity to evangelize our coworkers, although maybe we eventually will have an opportunity to do that, and that's fine. But thinking about the work itself as being valuable, that work done with excellence, contributes to society, like continuing to go on and,
yeah, right.
And participating in that is important to have a community or a city or a nation like flourish. And so we all play a role in that just by doing our daily work well.
Yeah. So much. Yes. Yes. That is such good stuff. And there's so much there, right? I mean, there's so many reasons I feel like we've gotten to where we have, so many like incorrect worldviews, or like just ways of putting together things, so much honestly Platonic philosophy. And you talk a little bit about this in the role of women, but just, you know, this like heaven is some ethereal place where our, you know, like disembodied and, mm-hmm. you know, that's the ultimate goal, is to sort of escape, you know, the physical nature, and just, there's so much. Like there's a whole big theology here that it's hard to unwrap. So speaking of, like, as you were talking about celebrity pastors, the longer I've done this work and sort of talked to people and pastors, I think a lot of the issue has come from this disconnect. Like pastors need to grow churches, right? That's how they make money. That's how they sort of, I mean, for a lot of people, that's how they build themselves up, maybe in unhealthy ways. And so when pastors make the only good work church work, where you're sort of building this church body as opposed to work out into the greater world, it benefits those churches and consequently those pastors in a lot of ways. And so,
yeah, I mean, I think there is a connection to the celebrity church culture, because I think a lot of us maybe grow up with this narrative or this sense that, okay, the most important work that we could do is ministry work, like connected to a formal church. And then you end up with a lot of people in ministry roles or pastoral roles that are perhaps not grounded enough and have not done the work of spiritual formation to really be equipped to responsibly lead a church. And that's really unfortunate, because then when you place someone in a position of spiritual leadership, the good that they do can really be amplified, but also their brokenness and flaws can also really be amplified and negatively affect other people's lives in damaging ways. So, you know, like, when we hear these stories of pastor, like a pastoral fail, you know, someone being disqualified from ministry, instead of thinking, well, how can we restore them to a position of spiritual leadership in the church? Maybe that person should just be working at like Home Depot for a while. Or, you know, what is it that we're so afraid to do, like that they don't get to do the more important spiritual work? Like, what if God actually wants that person to do quote unquote normal non-spiritual work, at least for a while, just to get grounded anyway?
in a you know, consumer facing job or in a retail space, you know, once you haven't done that for long enough, it is, it's hard to like connect, I think, in those ways.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. So for women specifically, I love how you couch this all in sort of the, in the creation. Can you just talk about that and like this co-image bearer sort of idea?
Yeah. I mean, it really is there on the first pages of scripture, which is that you know, God creates the first humans in God's image and blesses them and gives them this command to be fruitful and multiply and have dominion over all creation. And that's a paraphrase. But we see in those first pages of scripture, like maleness and femaleness are good. Those qualities are blessed by God. Men and women equally bear the image of God. And part of what it means to be an image bearer is to steward the world, basically, to steward creation for good purposes, both for provision, but also for flourishing, for like whole creational flourishing. And so a lot of theologians talk about that image from Genesis to be the cultural mandate. And it doesn't mean that all of us are called to be like farmers. You know, there's a metaphor here for stewarding culture. The word culture comes from an agricultural term meaning to like till, to till the ground. And so, you know, what does that mean for our daily work? Well, God cares about cultural flourishing. And when Christians participate in various spheres of cultural participation, kind of from high culture to low culture, or whether it's you have a lot of power, you don't have a lot of power, that all contributes to human flourishing. And so we're supposed to do our work well, with excellence, with care for our neighbors, with integrity. You know, we're supposed to, if we can, find work that really draws on our natural gifts and abilities and opportunities and education, that there's a sense of responsibility of using the talents that we've been given well. And I think there is an indirect evangelistic aspect of this as well, which is that, you know, our non-Christian neighbors, when they see a Christian engaging their daily work with excellence and integrity and care for their coworkers and a desire to collaborate with their colleagues, you know, all of those positive qualities do speak to Christians being people of integrity. That's a positive example and model that we can offer to the people around us.
That's great stuff. I love that. Yeah, it's just, I think we got so lost. And like, I know the industrialization has a lot to do with this, and like, you know, men sort of being forced away from home, wives, you know, you talk about in your book, like it wasn't having, I don't remember what the metaphor is, but anyway, like this, the sign of prosperity back in the day was having a housewife, you know, just how twisted we got all of that because of cultural reasons. But then we're like, oh no, these are spiritual reasons. You know, we make them biblical when they're not. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, part of what I hope to do in the book is to show that this notion of women, like all women at all times being called to be full-time stay-at-home moms, is very recent in history, right. You know, yeah. And it's also very contextual and very culturally oriented and very much growing out of the Industrial Revolution, which divided men and women during their days, kind of divided their labors, and kind of white American suburban culture of the 20th century really prized the ability to have the woman stay at home as a sign of like prosperity, that they could be like a single earner home. And it's kind of amazing and unfortunate how, because so many of us have grown up in that culture or with those cultural messages or narratives, that we read those narratives back into the biblical text And we all do this with many different things. You know, we're always bringing an interpretive lens to the scriptures.
Yep.
But part of what I wanted to do in the book is to show that, like, the things that we think of as kind of universal and there before all time, and kind of rooted in a timeless spiritual design, a lot of those things regarding women's roles are actually pretty recent and very contextual. And some of that too is just wanting to take a global perspective and thinking about, you know, I went on a developmental trip to Rwanda with a microfinance organization a few years ago just to see their work in the field. And we met many of their clients, and most of the clients that we interacted with are, you know, young women who have children, who day in and day out, they're running their small business, they're running a farm, they're growing crops, they're educating their children, they're doing so much, even though they're not in an office, even though they're not getting a paycheck, quote unquote, they are doing the daily work of providing for their families. And there's nothing in me that can say, well, they're not good Christian women because they're not stay-at-home moms. We need to have a vision of Christian womanhood that honors and praises women who are just getting the work done so that they can provide for their families and their neighbors, and they really don't have any other choice. And I think it would be wrong to fault them for that.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it is amazing how myopic that way of thinking is. You know what I mean? Like lays a way of thinking like a paradigm over every person's life who's lived, and you're like, that just it's taking it out. It's ahistorical, right? I mean, it's not rooted in the history of how the church has functioned, but it's also just like assumes so many things about how people's lives go and how they work out, and it's kind of crazy, to be honest with you. You know,
yes,
yeah, so. It's just amazing how we don't see how much culture affects us, and then we're really reticent to read any sort of culture back into scriptures. You know, these were people living in different times than us, you know, and in different places, and so we miss it sort of both ways, I guess. You know, imposing our culture that we don't realize we have onto the narrative of scripture. You know?
So, right.
Yeah, that's good. Caitlin, I could probably sit here and talk to you the entire day about theology and culture. This has been so pleasant, and all that stuff. Is there anything about the book that I know I could ask you so many questions, but is there anything about the book you feel like needs to be said here?
Well, in some ways we're in such a different moment culturally now than we were 4 years ago.
Right.
And I am just mindful of the fact that, you know, many of us, men and women, our daily work has been affected by the global pandemic and by restrictions on going into offices. You know, many of us have been furloughed or laid off, depending on what kind of industry we're in. And even, you know, many women who continue to work, maybe remotely or just via Zoom, are feeling the pinch of the responsibility of raising their children and caring for their children day in and day out in a way that, just kind of anecdotally, I don't think their husbands are to the same degree. And so just as my book is trying to create a vision for women's participation in the workplace, it's also an invitation for Christian men to engage the role of fatherhood and parenting and seeing that as a gift and a blessing.
Amen.
And that daily work and participation is a place of joy and sanctification and just a wonderful opportunity. I have one younger brother, and he and his wife have a 1-year-old, and Tyler, my brother, was working in a catering business and got furloughed, so he's been, you know, he's not been able to work for the last several months. And so he's really just taken on the role of stay-at-home dad, basically, while his wife, my sister-in-law works at a school, but he recently commented to me, I'm just so grateful to have this time with our child in these really formative early season of his child's life. Like, Tyler gets to be part of it in a unique way, and he's found a lot of purpose in that. And that's certainly not what all men are called to or what all men experience in raising a young child. But I do think that there is a gift and blessing there, just as there is a gift and blessing for women's engagement in the workforce.
No, like that was my reality before pandemic, and now it's even more so because my wife works out of the home and I never leave my house somehow. So, but I do. I think when we were talking about this industrial revolution pushing women into the home, and that being an expectation, I think it deprived women of work, but it also deprived dads of fatherhood. And I think it's fatherhood's a really beautiful thing when you can sort of lean into that. And I think that's a great word for us in this cultural moment right now, you know, especially, you know, maybe it's time to reassess the way that we thought about a lot of things. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good stuff. Caitlin, that was so fun. Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
The strangest job that I've ever had was probably delivering groceries through Instacart for 2 years. Nice. So when I had left CT in 2016, I was, you know, writing and speaking and picking up some editorial projects and just cobbling together this freelance life. And in the middle of that, I thought, what's something really easy and flexible that I could do with this spare time that I have? And so, like I would get these orders through the app and go run off to Whole Foods or Jewel and get someone else's groceries and deliver them. And it was actually, it could be very stressful depending on like the size of the order or where the person lived, or maybe they didn't tip you. Like, I certainly had negative experiences, but I like grocery shopping to begin with. And so it was kind of fun to like test myself to see how fast I could do it.
I love that.
Yes, I became very strategic about it and started to compete with myself. So, but that was, that was strange. I think I ended up making like $6,000 or $7,000.
That's legit.
Just like in a year. Yeah. And it was, like I said, it was super flexible. I could like just sign on for a few hours every week. So anyway.
Right. That's cool. I love that. Competition. It fuels everything. So
yeah,
that's good. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah. So I think one thing that really helped me see God at work in my daily work, kind of starting out in my career, is to believe that God had called me to work at a particular place for a particular time to learn important skills or lessons that I couldn't have learned elsewhere. So I think this really connects to a vision of God's sovereignty, and that where we work is not incidental, but is part of God's plan for our lives and for the world. And so even in moments starting out at Christianity Today, when I was very frustrated or stressed or felt a little alienated in the workplace culture, I really kept coming back to this sense that God had called me there for a reason and for a time, and that there were things that I could learn in that time that were important that could be used and applied later on. And so if any of your listeners are perhaps in a job they don't like, I mean, this is certainly not an argument just to grin and bear it forever because God wants to teach you a lesson, but really staying put and seeing that there might be an opportunity for growth and for change, even in the midst of a difficult work situation. And also just not thinking that your workplace bliss will be on the other side of, like, on with some other job. Like,
right.
It, the grass is always greener. Of course, I have a dream job in my head, and I, it's easy to compare what I have now with that dream job. But I have to remind myself that that dream job could, in fact, be a bad job, depending on so many factors that I couldn't know from the outside. Yeah. And so, yeah, just really, I think there's something to the value of staying put and committing to a place and to a role, a responsibility for a time, and wanting to glean the most out of it that you can for that season.
Yeah. That's good stuff, Caitlin. I really appreciate that. I think that's a good word for us all. So thanks so much for making some time for me and coming on the show. It was awesome to get to chat.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Caitlin and just this really important discussion that we're having here. I mean, if you really want to delve deeper into some of the theology behind some of this and just Caitlin's perspective, I highly encourage you to go pick up her book. It's awesome. It's very readable, very understandable. And there's just a lot of great stuff there. She has a lot of great experience and wisdom, as you can see from this interview. So check that out. Follow her on Twitter, all the socials. They're in the show notes there for you to easily follow. And now is a great time to slide to the bottom of your iTunes app, and you can leave a rating and review for me there, which just helps get the word out about A Theology of Hustle. Tells people that other people are listening. It's just super helpful. And I greatly appreciate knowing that you're listening and enjoying. So do all that for me. I greatly appreciate it. And until next time, get out there and hustle.